Morning, everybody. We'll continue where we left off. We were discussing fires and Shabbos, which I was just thinking yesterday how appropriate to the day. With Lag BaOmer today, and everybody makes bonfires on Lag BaOmer night. But I think that's as far as the connection goes, and I'm not going to spend time talking about that. So we'll continue with I call it emergencies because in the mindset it's talk about fires, others emergencies, and then essentially we come to the end of Chelek Aleph and the Shmir Shabbos Kilchos. I've been following his order and will bring us to the end, and on next week in Metz Hashem we'll continue with a whole new subject of preparing for Shabbos and really going back to, essentially going back to the very beginning, is more the halachas of Friday rather than the halachas of Shabbos. The last thing we spoke about was that I was having this discussion with my chavrusa. Let's go take a step back. When there is a fire, so the halacha is that we may not do kibbuy on Shabbos unless it borders on pikuach nefesh, as we've said many times. Sakanos nefashos doesn't have to be vaday, even safek. If there's any possibility of sakanos nefashos, then we are mechal on Shabbos. So the typical example is given: if a wall falls down and you don't know if someone was caught under that collapsed wall, and you don't know if he's Jewish, and you don't even know if there's a chance that someone fell out or got caught under the wall, we don't know if he's alive. Nevertheless, we have a triple suffix over there. Suffix someone's there, suffix if he's Jewish, suffix if he's alive. Nevertheless, on the chance that he's Jewish and alive, we mechalel Shabbos in order to dig out and see if and what. So when you have a suffix nefashos, the halacha is that we mechalel Shabbos. So when there's a fire in an apartment, the halacha is that we call the fire department, because fire in our apartments today generally lead to sakanos nefashos. I just read an article 2-3 days ago, maybe it was yesterday even. There was a fire in the Kiriya on the top floor, and it was 6:45 in the morning. By the time the fire department came, there were two people were injured. Baruch Hashem, lightly injured, sent to hospital for smoke inhalation. But even there, it's an apartment. Apartments are made of concrete. You ask yourself what burns. There's enough in an apartment to burn. They're hot enough and give enough smoke, thick black smoke. Therefore, generally speaking, before we even discuss any example, we've got to say that fire in our apartment are considered as sakanos nefashos. And you call the fire department, even if it's here and it's over, and the firemen are Jewish, and they've got to get into a fire truck, and they've got to drive, and there's phone calls that need to be made, we do that. But we were discussing the theoretical case, which is not so practical, is a fire that is isolated, and you know for sure that there's no threat to life. An example, a standalone home, and you know that everybody has been evacuated from the house. There is no doubt that there's anybody caught in the house. It's standalone. There's no way that the fire, under normal circumstances, can go any further. I said to Machabusa, take an example of a castle with a moat around it, with full of water. So, if the castle goes up on fire, but you know that no one's inside, then that would be an example of a fire on Shabbos where you're not allowed to extinguish the fire. Which is an interesting discussion, which I'll share with you, is in halacha it's discussed to what financial expense is a person mechuyev to in order to keep mitzvah. So the topic comes up in Hilchos Arba Minim, and it says that a person should spend a third in order to increase the quality of his mitzvah to go to buy hidur mitzvah. So the one says a third of what you have. That means if three mitzvahs come your way, that means you go bankrupt. So answer the Gemara, no. Doesn't mean a third of what you own, but a third of the mitzvah that you're doing. If a kosher esro costs $100, so then a third of that, question is what is a third of the total, that means you pay, if you should pay $150, which now $50 is a third of the total price, isn't a third of what you pay, or a third of 100, which is the original price. Gemara calls it milagav and milabaz, machlokas, but the question is whether it's either $130 or $150. If something costs $100, so in order to be mekayim a hidur mitzvah, you should spend up to a third and not more than that, and then you mekayem the mitzvah. More than that is not necessary. From there leads on to the next question. What happens if you don't have an esrog? So they're talking about you have an esrog. Now the question is, a cheaper one or a more expensive one? What happens if you don't have an esrog? How much are you supposed to spend to get hold of an esrog? How much are you supposed to spend to get hold of tefillin? How much do you spend in order to be able to say Kriya Shema? Whatever a mitzvah you've got to do. So the Gemara says that we learned that you can spend up to 20% of what you are worth. Your kol m'moinoi, we talk about 20%. Aliyah vazvez adam yosef michoimish, a person should not spend more than a fifth. It's brought down in Hilchot Staka. And the reason is because more than that will lead you to poverty, and then eventually you become a burden on society. And therefore, a person may not spend more than a fifth. There is a discussion, someone who is super wealthy, and if he spent 80% of his money on a mitzvah, and he'd still be left with enough money to live happily ever after, may he do that? A lot of poskim say yes. But generally speaking, on someone who's not in that category, we say up to a fifth of your money can be spent on a mitzvah. The second mitzvah is not another fifth, but rather a fifth of what remains. So you're always breaking it down to the remainder, therefore you always remain with 80% of what you started off. That is the guideline that is given. The Gemara gives a story that Rabbi Gamliel once spent 1,000 zuz on an esrog, and the Gemara says that because he was very wealthy and that was considered within his means, and it was not considered more than a chomesh, and therefore he was allowed to do it. On the other hand, so that's, we see quite clear sources as to how much a person spends at a heder mitzvah in order to be mekayem a mitzvah. What about the negative, to avoid doing an avera? How much must a person spend to avoid doing an avera? So it's brought down, the Mishavur Derech Agav there in Hilchos Avot Minim brings it, and it's a Ramah in Hilchos Avodah Zarah. It says that when it comes to avoiding doing a mitzvah, so then you have to spend everything you have in order to avoid doing a mitzvah. So the example brought down is if a person was under duress to transgress an avera. The example, what the Havalacha says is that if a person is under duress, that he's been threatened, either transgress an avera or the person will kill him, so then we say, except for the three cardinal sins, the person does not need to give up his life, and could be that it's also to give up his life in certain circumstances, in certain circumstances not also, but he doesn't have to, and rather he should transgress the avera. If the person who's forcing him to do the avera has an intention in order, because he holds that he wants what the halacha says, ma'aviro al hadas, he wants to force him away from his religion, if the situation is religiously motivated, then a person may give up his life in order to avoid being over on an avera that is not one of the three cardinal sins. So we were talking, an example would be if a person is held by gunpoint, and the holder of the gun says to the Jew, make me a cup of coffee on Shabbos. So making a cup of coffee would require to make a fire and then to boil the water, which are Isura Daraisa. So how much must a person, what is the situation, how much must a person give in order to avoid making that cup of coffee? So if it's a question of life and death, he just gives one eitzah, I'll kill you if you don't do it. So then do it, because you don't die for such a mitzvah. If you know that he's doing it in order to be mavira ala das, to there's religious motivation over here. So then it's a choice a person can choose. There's nothing wrong. It's not considered suicidal to be killed for such a thing. The Ramah then makes a comment. It says, and if you can get rid of the onus by paying him off, so then you're mechuyev to do it. And how much you're mechuyev to do it? He says, there's no limit. So I looked in the Rishonim, and it's interesting, they don't bring a Gemara, but they say our Piswara. The logic is that we don't see anywhere in the Torah that avaris become mutter because of monetary circumstances. Are you going to tell me many, many times we see that when there's hefsid, we see you can do this and that, for example. Mukta, we often talk about that if there's hefsid meruba, we're going to be more makel or something like that on Durabonon. So first of all, that's on Durabonon, it's not on Doraisis. And second of all, the cases that we bring in Hefsid is usually when we have two opposing opinions, And we paskin the halacha like the more stringent opinion. But when there is monetary loss involved, so then we'll say you can rely on the more lenient opinion. So it's not that you're doing a transgression, it's you're going against the psak that we have two opinions, and we generally go with a stringent opinion, so we allow you to use the more lenient opinion in order to save yourself money. That is allowed, and that comes, that is very commonly used in psak, in your Yoredeya. Go to a Rav with a kashrus question. If there is a lot of loss involved, he's going to have to throw out the food, and you've made an enormous amount. Very often, the Rav might paskin lekula, not that he's allowing you to eat treif chas v'shalom, but rather he's relying on the shittas that generally we don't rely on, but here we'll rely on them. So that's when we bring in hefsid. But if it's a clear-cut avera, so the clear-cut avera, and according to a lot of opinions, even the rabbonos, but it's clear-cut, there's no machlokas about it, it's clear what it is. I gave an example. The person's held at gunpoint to make to boil a cup of water on Shabbos and make a cup of coffee for the person who's holding the gun. So one has, again, to give up your life is not necessary. It might even be also if it was not religiously motivated. And if it's, and what happens if you can turn around and say, listen, I'll give you $100 if you put that gun down. And if he says yes, so then that's what you're mechuyev to do. You're mechuyev to pay him off in order to make sure that you don't get into the situation of an avera. So we see that it's very interesting that when it comes to avoiding averas, so the rishonim, there's some that categorize it as a difference between mitzvah sasei and mitzvah sasei. Others say that it's a question of whether it's active or passive. If a person's going to be passive and he's not going to be mekayim a mitzvah as a result of his passivity, so then he's not mechuyev to spend more than a fifth of his wealth in order to be mekayem the mitzvah. Whereas it's active, if a person's under duress to actively transgress, then we say that he has to spend as much as he has in order to avoid that transgression. So if a person would be locked in a room and he couldn't be mekayem the tefillin, so that's a positive commandment. So how much must he pay in order to get out of that room? So there's only midin choymish. It's from this, from the idea of 20%, and not that he has to pay. He's under duress, right? But that's not actively being over on an avera. It's just passively not being mekayim a mitzvah. So how does discussions come up? Because one of the examples in Hilchos Shabbos, there's two examples in Hilchos Shabbos that are brought down. One is that a person who lives in a town, and he hears that the town is being attacked. There's a gang that's coming into town and they're going to attack it. So he wants to know, can he be Mechalel Shabbos in order to save the town from the gang? So we make him a clear distinction halacha. If there would be a chance that they would be violent and they would be lost to life, so then you can call the authorities, you can bring in the army, you can arm yourself, you can shoot, you can do whatever's needed in order to defend the city. But if you know that they are purely coming on a monetary basis, that it's just going to loot the stores, but they happen to be very dignified gangsters, I mean, go find me such gangsters, that's a harder story, that's obviously very theoretical, but they're very dignified gangsters, they don't take human life, they only steal. So if you're certain that they're only coming to loot the stores, then there's nothing you can do on Shabbos. You can't break Shabbos in order to stop them. You have to let them go. There is an exception to the rule that if it's a city on the border, then you may stop them, but that's for a different reason, because if you show softness on border towns, then before you know it, they take over the town, and then they go to the next town, and then take over that one, and go to the next one, because each time they come on Shabbos, the local residents don't do anything, and before you know it, you lose your country. So that's because you look at the bigger picture, so border towns have a different din. But we see over there that when it comes to a monetary loss, you're mechuyev to sustain the loss and not to be over Shabbos in order to protect yourself. Another example is what we were discussing is regarding a fire. If a person is witness to a fire, whether it's his own home or another home, makes no difference. If there is a certainty that there is no pikuach nefesh, there's nothing that can be done in order to extinguish the fire. And we say that if the fire is on your own property and it's your own things that are burning, so we added last week that's not only can you not extinguish the fire, but even to save things that are not yet burned, Chazal limited us because we have a concept called Adam Bahul Amramoina, a person becomes very involved in his own assets, and because of the fact that there's an emergency going on, he becomes unaware, he forgets that it's Shabbos, and he might come to extinguish the fire. So if you tell him he's allowed to save whatever is not burnt, and he's running in and out of his house before it catches onto the next room, we're afraid that he will forget that it's Shabbos and extinguish the fire, and therefore we gave limitations of what he can save on Shabbos. So that was what we spoke about last week, how much you're allowed to save food-wise and things that are related to food. We mentioned at the end that when it comes to Sifrei Kodesh, anything which is considered a holy sefer, whether it be Torah Shebu'ah, B'Chsav, or Torah Shebu'ah Peh, may be saved from a fire. There's no limits, and it's a mitzvah to go save them. And interesting, Derech Agav, it's mentioned over there that if you have a sefer that was written by an apikoros, then not only do you not save it, but it's a mitzvah to let it get burnt.
No.
When it comes to Sifrei Kodesh, you may go run into the burning house, obviously without danger to your own life. You're clear that that this part of the house hasn't caught fire yet and it's safe to go in, then you can go in and save the Sifrei Kodesh. Now, when it comes to getting a goy to take out the fire, we still don't allow the rabbanans. You cannot call a goy, so even if you're in Chutz La'aretz where the fire department is manned by goyim, you can't go call them to come extinguish the fire. Again, we're talking in the theoretical case where there's no threat to life. Otherwise, generally speaking, again, most of our fires are life-threatening, and you do call the fire department, irrelevant of who's going to come. So you can't tell a goy to come. Amir al-Akum remains asur, even in the case of a severe loss. But you're allowed to be meramez. You can give a hint, so you can tell a goy who's going past that you should know that whoever takes care of extinguishing this fire will not lose out financially. And he understands that means that you will compensate him for his efforts to extinguish the fire, and that gives an incentive to come and do it. You're allowed to do that. That's a remez, and a remez you can do, but you can't do a direct amira. An exception to the rule is that if there are Kitzur HaKodesh in the house, so then you can do an Amir al-Akum in order to save the Kitzur HaKodesh. So if the house is burning, again, no Pikuach Nefesh, but there are Svarim in the house, so then you may alert a goy and tell him to come. Of course, you can't be over on a drabon. You can't pick up, you can't pick up a phone and call him. But if there's a goy nearby, you tell him, please call the fire department. And the fire department is going. It's not Yidden. So then you can call. But you can get a goy to call the fire department in order to save your house. I didn't see it brought in the Shemir Shabbos, and I didn't look up where I saw it, but I have heard that people say there will be a heter to call the fire department if the mezuzahs are going to get burnt, because mezuzahs are Kitzur HaKodesh, and if you know that the mezuzahs are going to get burnt, and if you call the fire department, that would save the mezuzahs, and then you can do an Amir al-Akam. Again, you can't make the call yourself, but you can tell a goy to make the call and get the fire department to come. If a goy's house is burning, and there's a threat that if it's not taken care of, it will spread further, and it might affect your own home, so then you're allowed to alert the goy to the fact and even encourage him to take care of it. You can offer him compensation for his efforts, etc. Obviously, you can't do an isur. You can't pick up the phone and call the fire department, but you can alert him to the fact and even tell him, go put the fire out, because that's not for your case. So therefore, there's no amira over here, even though you indirectly gain from it. Now, this might be a little bit more practical, and that is on smaller fires. For example, if a candle falls on the tablecloth and it's not spreading very fast, it's still a very small fire and it's still under control. You see it. So now it's not yet Sakonas Nefashos. How can you act? So as you said, you cannot put out a fire on Shabbos, but you can do things to mitigate the spread of the fire, and therefore you can do what's called gram kibui. So for example, if a tablecloth catches fire, you can wet part of the tablecloth that is not yet burning, may be wet. You put a liquid on it, and that would, when the fire reaches it, won't burn it any further. So if you've got a small area that's burning and you put a bit of water around that small area, you know, it will reach that wetness, and then the fire's out. So we're not talking about Sakonas Nefashos, still a very controlled small fire. What you can do in order to keep it under control and let it go out, there's just something to keep in mind, that pouring water on a tablecloth is a problem of Malabin, because we hold the Shriyus HaZeo Kibusai. letting something soak in water on Shabbos causes it to get clean, and therefore that's the issur melaveh. Therefore, the liquid you should not be clean water, but rather use soda or juice or something like that, something that liquid that is not clear and cleaning like water, but something else. Then you may do that, and that would stop the fire. Another example given, what they used in old days was they used earthenware vessels that were sensitive to heat. If they got too hot, they would crack. So you filled up earthenware vessels with water and you put them in the path of the fire. When the fire got to them, it would heat up these vessels and the vessels would crack and then the water would come out and extinguish the fire. The practical way of doing that today would be to put water into plastic, whether a plastic cup or a plastic bag, and then put these bags near the advancing fire. And when the fire gets to the bag, the heat of the fire will melt the plastic and cause the water to come out, and that would extinguish the fire. That is mutter, that is considered as grand kibbutz. Again, only in controlled situations where you have no thought of it leading to pikuach nefesh. Then there's an issue of mukta if a candle fell onto the table. So we're not worried about sakanas nefashos because nothing yet has caught fire or it's fallen in a way where the flame is not touching the tablecloth, but it fell onto the table. So now from midine mukta, what can you do? So a candle remains mukta, and you can't, but you do want to remove it from the table. So mukta can be moved to the minatzad or to the begufay, so you can take the table and tilt it and let the candle roll off, or you can take the tablecloth and hold it and lift the tablecloth and carry it to a safe place and let the candle roll onto the floor. Those are mutter because you're not doing direct tiltul, you're doing tiltul minatzad. Minatzad means through with something else, or you can do tiltul begufo, which means to move it with a different part of your body, not your hands. You could kick it. The thing is that when you move such a candle, you have to watch out that it is going to go out, so you have to do it very gently. If it anyway goes out, despite the fact that you were gentle, that's not a problem, because that's, as we've said, that the difference between obsecration and davashem is kavim. Obsecration is when the secondary result is for sure going to happen, then it will be obsecration. Whereas if it's not for sure it's going to happen, so even if it happens anyway, that's a davashem is kavim. The example always given to differentiate the two is if you're taking a heavy piece of furniture and pulling it across an earth floor, will it leave a groove in the floor? If it's heavy enough that you know for sure it's going to leave a groove, it's secretia. If it's that type of weight that you're not sure it's going to leave a groove, so then you may pull it across. After you look back, you see there was a groove, you don't have to worry because it was a davar shemishkaven. So here also, when it comes to moving this candle, again, we're not talking about we're worried about a major fire breaking out. That would be a separate story. But what you would do is you'd put liquid to stop the fire from spreading. You're not allowed to actively extinguish it, but you can take a grand kibbutz situation. You can passively do something. That's not what we're dealing with, but rather the actual din of mukta. So mukta candle cannot be carried unless there's a danger. If you leave the candle on the table, chas v'shalom, it could catch fire and cause then a danger to the family, or a child might touch it or something like that. Mukta, b'makom danger, doesn't exist, and therefore the same type of thing will say that if a utensil in your house breaks, it becomes mukta because it's no longer usable on Shabbos, if it's not usable. But if a glass dish breaks and now you have shards of glass on the floor, so that is a danger for people to step on it and hurt themselves. Therefore, we push aside mukta, and it is mutter to clean up the broken shards from the floor. Okay, now we have a few more minutes left. So that's the end of fire. There's a couple of other examples of things that are mutter to be machal Shabbos because of sakanas nefashos. So as you said, not only the examples that we brought above of sakanas nefashos, whether it's a health issue and a medical issue, you've got to call the ambulance, or a fire and you call the fire department. There are other cases, anytime that we're aware that this sakanas nefashos, we may break Shabbos in order to take care of the problem. An example given is a child who got lost, a young child who got lost, and we're afraid for his safety. You may do what is needed in order to get that child, to find the child, and if it means calling the police, and the police are going to come by car, and they're going to start a search party, and they're going to alert people, you call Hatzolah, and they're going to bring volunteers. If there is cause for concern, then that is that could lead to Sakanas Nefashos, and therefore you do make the phone call. Or even the other way around, you found a child roaming the streets without any adult supervision. Unfortunately, this does happen and happens amongst the best of people. So we're not pointing fingers at anybody, but it happens sometimes that a child may get out without the parent's attention, and now the child's roaming the streets, and the child is anxious and doesn't know how to get home again, and you find the child and you have no idea where the child lives or who the child is and who the parent of the child is not cooperating or unable to cooperate, too young to explain who, where they live and what's going on. And the only way to locate the family would be to alert the authorities or to call in Hatzalah, whatever the case may be. This is considered also, in, or if you cannot calm the child down any other way, obviously if you can give him a candy and spread the word orally that, you know, you found a kid and he's sitting in your house and he's eating a lollipop and he's happy as a lark, so then fine, you can't be Mechallel Shabbos. But if he's crying and you can see that he's very upset and you can't calm him down and he wants his mummy, that is considered as Sakanas Nefashos. We also say that a child that's locked in a room, you can break the door down on Shabbos because of the fact that this anxiety can be a threat to his health and safety. So we mentioned at the beginning when we were talking about the examples of Sakanas Nefashos. So we gave we said that when it comes to monetary loss, you can't be over. So we gave an example of a city that's going to be attacked. If you have these strange type of attackers that only come for financial gain and you're certain they're not going to cause any harm, bodily harm to the people, then there's nothing you can do on Shabbos. But the converse is obviously true, that if you there's a threat to human life, then obviously there's nothing that stands in the way to protect yourself. And therefore, if a person has heard of an infiltration of terrorists, to use a unfortunately modern terminology of this, then we would say that you alert the authorities, the relevant authorities, and do whatever you need to do. If you're part of a civil defense unit, then you can take up arms and do what, and communicate and do whatever is necessary in order to take care of this problem. That's obviously, as you said, that's not a chiddush, but we're saying it. A soldier who's on duty may fulfill his duties, but he has to know that there's certain things that get done that are not necessary for pikuach nefesh, and he has to know where to, what things he can do, what things he can't do. So to fight and to shoot his gun and to travel to places and move around, these are all things that are important in order for the maneuvers of an army, and he has to follow his orders. But if he is wearing an ID tag, which really is not going to help win the war or lose the war, and there's other reasons for it, could be that he can only be over in Drabonon to carry his ID tag, and therefore to carry his ID tag, it's not considered a tash, it's not considered like jewelry, and therefore would be considered carrying. And if there's any time that he can leave it behind, he should. But if he has to take it with him, so then he should not wear it in a place that is a Rishus HaRabim Midoraisa, which is not so practical because most of their work is done out in the fields, and that is considered, there's no 600,000 people there, there's no proper streets. That's all considered the Kamaris, it's all a Makom Derabanan. If a soldier has to be on sentry duty or he's doing patrols of a neighborhood, so he may take his weapon with him, but he should try hang the weapon over his shoulder and not to carry it in his hand. That would be a shinui from the normal, not really a shinui because he went out that way, but it's not considered as tilta b'yad. It would be considered maybe derech levisha, it would lower the isur. So these are things that a person has to keep in mind if he's in that situation. But he can take whatever he needs. He can take a flashlight with if he's on night duty, and he can use the flashlight if he has suspicions that he needs to check up on something suspicious. And not only that, he can turn it off again when he's finished, because as we said before, that once you turn something on, it's not possible to turn it off. It's only if you're worried that you might need it again and the battery's going to run out. If a person is patrolling and is on sentry duty, then unless it's the end of his duty and each person comes with his own flashlight, so he won't need the flashlight again on Shabbos, so then fine, then once he turns it on, he can't turn it off. But if there's a possibility it needs to be used again, so then he should turn it off. If a person is on sentry duty and he needs to go to the central depot and pick up his equipment, and now they won't let him take his equipment unless he signs out on it, so here they point out that signing out on it is an Issur d'Oraisa to sign, And it doesn't help the pikuach nefesh, just because there's an enemy coming and he needs to fight the enemy. The fact whether he signed or didn't sign is not going to make a difference to the ability to conquer the enemy, and therefore there's no heter for him to put his signature in the logbook, and he has to refuse. Not only that, he has to refuse even if it would mean that the soldier on duty is going to sign on his behalf, and the soldier on duty is a Jew, so you're causing another Jew to do it. That's not your issue. Your issue is you're not allowed to do it. If that's what he does as a result, then that's his problem, not yours. And or if your person doesn't sign, he's going to be court-martialed. That also is something that he has to allow himself to be put through, because you don't do an Issa D'oraisa in order to do something that is clearly not related to Sakonas Nefashos. Obviously, if he can get a way around it, he can leave a deposit, he can leave a piece of ID, put a credit card down or something like that. You give them something and you say, Moitzei Shabbos, I come back when I pick up my item, so you know I'm going to come back on Moitzei Shabbos because I've left a deposit, and then I'll sign the book. That's what a person has to make an effort in order to do, in order to not write on Shabbos in a situation that is not considered clearly Sakonas Nefashos. So too, if a person receives a conscription letter on Shabbos, and the person delivering the registered mail wants a signature to show that he's received it, but also that's not global on Sakonas Nefashos. The conscription, the going up and going into the army is necessary, but signing that you received your papers is not part of the cheshbon, and he should not sign it on Shabbos. If a person is conscripted on Shabbos and he packs his bags to go, he may pack things that are not 100% necessary for today, like he can take with his tefillin, because he might need them tomorrow, but he should pack them all in one bag, so when he's carrying the things that are necessary for today, it's a derech agav, you're carrying the other things, and if he has to travel by bus or by car or something like that, then he shouldn't hold the bag, he should let the bag just sit in the vehicle, and remember, he's not actually carrying it out of the tulum, and he's not carrying the things that are unnecessary, but he may take things with him. If a religious soldier has been given a turn of duty on Shabbos, and he has the ability to switch that for a weekday, and someone else will do Shabbos, so it depends on who's taking his place. If another Jewish soldier will take his place, that is not considered a good switch, because hafuch, the Jewish soldier who was asked to do the job on Shabbos, he's someone who is shomer Shabbos, and he's conscious of what he can do, what he can't do, and he will minimize that. He will do, security-wise, his job is just as good, but Shabbos-wise, it's way better, because he will minimize doing things that are also to do. Whereas if you give it over to a Mechamel Shabbos to take his place, security-wise, it's the same thing, but Shabbos-wise, he might do many other things unrelated to the security situation, and because you've asked him to stand on guard, and therefore a person should not switch his Toranut with another Jewish soldier just to avoid working on Shabbos, because you're just causing more Chilul Shabbos that way. If a person is called up to duty and there's a possibility of walking to his base, then he cannot go by car. In fact, if a person knows there's a high chance that he'll be called up on Shabbos, or his turn starts on Shabbos morning, let us say I know of firemen work 24 hours at a time. They work from 7 in the morning till 7 in the morning. So his duty starts 7 in the morning on Shabbos morning. So he cannot say, well, my job is something that leads to Sakonas Nefashos, and therefore I may drive to my job. No, he knows in advance that it's coming. And it's not like a woman who's giving birth, where we say she doesn't have to take up residence next to the hospital during the whole 9 months, because she might need to go in. But there, a woman, the moment she goes into labor, becomes a Vada Pikuach Nefesh. He has a suffix to Koch Nefesh, what's going to be, and he can prepare in advance. So it's on him to make sure that if he's got duty, say 7 o'clock in the morning on Shabbos morning, that Friday night he spends in a place where he can walk to his job and not have to take a car or something which involves an Issur D'oraisa. If a person sees the Hefetz Chashud or anything else that is suspicious, then you call the relevant authorities and don't say, well, Shabbos today, I'm not picking up a phone. If they see a suspicious person loitering in the neighborhood, if there's reason to consider that there's danger there, then you call the authorities and don't think twice. And one more thing, a soldier who's on duty on Yom Kippur and feels that his ability to serve will be compromised if he doesn't drink or eat, so then it is necessary for him then to be in his best form. I don't mean to say that, okay, it's harder. So there'll be a compromise in his ability to do what he has to do. So then we'll say that he may eat or drink, lav dafka, whatever's necessary, the minimal amount, and he should take it, ensuring, like with if possible, small amounts with big breaks of time in between, and that way he can keep himself hydrated and not have a full shiur at one time and not over on the din of a shiur. The mice, as we said, shiurim is not a, it's not mutter, it's also just you don't reach the stage of becoming an isur where it's chayav in a punishment, but it's still also. And with that, we get to the end of the section and the end of the shiur for today. And we wish everybody a wonderful Lag BaOmer, and Yom Tov, we'll meet again next week.
Thank you.